Welcome to BRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Rick Rosoff. Rick's been on a number of times before. I'm sure we'll have him back again. Rick heads the Stop NATO. He's the editor of the Stop NATO website. He follows NATO very, very closely. He follows events. So much goes on that's related to NATO. There's no question about that. Anything geopolitical, anything related to possible military action is certainly NATO related and NATO affected. Rick, there's so much going on. I'm very, very obsessed with what's happening in Egypt right now. I'd like to get your comments on it. I would mention I've written two articles about the bloodletting that went on Wednesday. I called it Egypt blood in the streets. The second article I put out tomorrow was called Egypt's Bloody Wednesday. I compared it very briefly to 1972 Northern Ireland that was called Bloody Sunday, killed less than 20 people, maybe a dozen people or so, or fewer than that, maybe twice as many were injured. So comparing the two is a very, very bad analogy, but you get the idea. Bloody Sunday, Bloody Wednesday. The official numbers of people killed on Wednesday released by the government, the junta government, the military government, the last number I saw was 625. You can bet you the number is at least double. And the Muslim Brotherhood, the elected government, Mohamed Morsi and his people, some of them are estimating multiples higher than that 600. I've seen numbers as high as 10,000. I don't think it's 10,000, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if it's a few thousand. And there's more violence on the streets today. There's a march of anger that's ongoing. Rick, I have a live feed on my desktop with the sound muted showing peaceful crowds. They're gathering, they're assembling, and they're gathering for after Friday prayers. And I do believe that whatever violence has come from the protesters has been very, very minimal. And the violence, at least 99% of it, has been state-sponsored, with snipers on roofs, with security forces all over the place, and they have been ordered to use lethal fire for pretexts such as attacking government buildings. Well, Rick, you know, they don't need any pretext. They can do whatever they want, and they can claim whatever they want. Your comments about what's going on?
I mean, it is a bloodbath, as you're describing it. And it's, unfortunately, without going too far back in time, it's the inevitable result of the U.S. having meddled in Egypt, starting from at least 1979 with the first Camp David Accords. And this was a point at which, you know, many of your listeners are too young to even have been alive at that time, much less to recall it, but it was a very significant period in history. It was a Carter administration where his foreign policy was effectively being run by his national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was not only an arch anti-communist, but he was a pathological Russophobe. And during his, the one term of the Carter administration, Brzezinski very avidly pursued building up a global military alliance against the then Soviet Union, including weaning away former Soviet allies and clients like Mohammed Siad Barre in Somalia. And the U.S. meddling in Somalia has contributed no small part to the decades-long catastrophe in that country. But in fact, by buying off Anwar Sadat and the Egyptian government to the tune of some $3 billion a year, making it one of the two largest recipients of U.S. foreign aid and two largest recipients of military aid in the world, the pieces were put into place for the catastrophe that has unraveled ever since. And most recently, of course, since the commencement of the so-called Arab Spring, in the beginning of 2011. And what we're now seeing is a very military that's been trained and armed and advised, and I'm sure in some instances commanded by the United States, is being turned on Egyptian citizens. Though I think one thing that's very important to mention here, that, you know, as non-Egyptians, Stephen, of course, neither you nor I are taking sides in an internecine civil conflict that is costing the lives of several hundred people. And we have to realize that what the U.S. may ultimately have succeeded in doing is to unite all factions of Egyptian society against itself. We have to recall that those who opposed the Mubarak 30-year presidency 2.5 years ago were opposed to the United States for supporting him. Those who supported him ultimately felt he had been betrayed by the United States. I'm talking about the infamous mission of Frank Wisner Jr., about which we can speak perhaps, that ultimately delivered the political, at least, and probably physical death sentence for Mubarak. And now what we've seen for several months is the opponents of the former Morsi government are out with placards and banners. You've seen them on the Internet. Most of your listeners have, condemning the U.S. for supporting the Muslim Brotherhood. And now we have the U.S. Supporting the military that's slaughtering supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood. So, if anything will ultimately unite Egyptian society at this point, it's going to be their aversion to U.S. meddling in their country.
And aversion to U.S. meddling is very, very strong, Rick. I wrote an article about anti-American sentiment in Egypt and really, really virulent signs and banners with people on the streets. This was before the catastrophe on Wednesday with so much carnage, and it's going to continue because the Brotherhood supporters, they had a government, they had an elected government. It wasn't the most prettily elected government, but it was about as democratic as anything Egypt ever saw, and it was toppled, and Washington was very, very much involved in toppling the government, where it either signed off on what was planned or it helped orchestrate the ouster of Morsi when it also helped orchestrate the ouster of Mubarak, who was a good U.S. ally for many, many years, but he fell out of favor for many reasons, including not being completely on board with all of America's imperial wars. Rick, maybe mm-hmm. supported mm-hmm. some of them, but didn't support them all. He very much was against the war in Iraq and made his feelings known. So he fell out of favor. It was just a matter of time before America was going to get rid of him, and 2011 was the time. Who ever heard of a leader out of nowhere? Protests began against him in January 2011, and 18 days later, a guy who was a brutal military dictator for 30 years with control of the military and everything else was out of power. Who ever heard of anything like that before? Unless it was all orchestrated, manipulated, and the military was conspiring with Washington, and Mubarak's gone. I don't know what the devil's going on with him now. He's been put on trial, and he goes on, and it's delayed, and it's back and forth, and this and that. He claims he's ill. Maybe he's ill. Maybe he's not. I don't know. But he's out of power. His son's very rich. He's very rich. And now you've got what's going on now. And there's no question that Washington's dirty hands are all over this thing. And if you took a poll in Egypt, I think you'd probably find 90% of the Egyptian people who absolutely detest America.
Yeah, and from all factions. And we have to recall this is there are elements of a color revolution scenario, of course, in the overthrow of Mubarak. And, I have very strong feelings about people who claim to be ostensibly anti-interventionists and anti-imperialists and progressive and so forth, who uncritically cheered on the so-called Arab Spring. By the way, Arab Spring or Arab Awakening are the very terms used by the U.S. White House, the U.S. State Department, and the U.S. Department of Defense, the Pentagon. And when we catch ourselves using the same terminology and applauding the same events as those three institutions, it's time for a serious reevaluation. But let us recall that what's going on today is not unprecedented. That, as a matter of fact, when the Mubarak government was told by the United States to step down, and again, Frank Wisner Jr. was a man who delivered that verdict, delivered that death sentence politically, he was succeeded for 16 months by a military junta. People seem to have forgotten the so-called Supreme Council of the Armed Forces. It was headed up by Field Marshal Mohammed Hussein Tantawi. And during that 16-month period, something in the neighborhood of 30, as I recollect, or 36,000 people were tried under martial law conditions, which was a larger number than during the entire 30-year reign of Hosni Mubarak. And we have to remember whose military this is and has been since 1979. For example, just yesterday the White House announced they were canceling the biennial, the every 2 year joint military exercises, and they're colossal, called Bright Star in Egypt. They were canceled 2 years ago, the last scheduled one because of the upheaval in the country. But they have been occurring every 2 years since 1980. That is, the very year after the Camp David Accord, the Pentagon insinuated itself in Cairo, in Egypt, and has been leading large-scale military exercises since. It has effectively taken over the Egyptian military. So, in 2011, with the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, and currently with its equivalent, the U.S. has no plausible deniability. It is unquestionable, you know, who has funded, trained, and is ultimately responsible for the military in Egypt. It is the Pentagon and the White House.
Oh, there's no question about that, Rick. The latest SCAF, Supreme Council of the Armed Forces head, General Sisi, he was trained in Egypt, but he was also trained at a U.S. war college, and I believe Tantawi and probably the other key generals were the same thing. And, of course, Latin American and other military people, I believe officer ranks and up, maybe from captain on up, are trained at the infamous School of the Americas that was renamed because the name was so infamous. But that goes on, and there are lots of places.
A lot of them at Fort Leavenworth, that's,
oh, yeah.
It seems to be.
Oh, the former general in charge of Rwanda? Oh, what's his name?
Paul Kagame,
right. He was trained at Fort Leavenworth years ago, and he was involved in the situation in the Rwanda and Burundi, where an aircraft was shot down, killing the Burundi president, killing the Rwandan president. It was all set up for what would follow. Kagame gets in power. I don't know that it was a genocide, but there certainly was mass slaughter, and it was orchestrated during the senior Bush administration, and the Clinton administration took over where senior Bush left off, and nothing was done to stop this thing. And the idea always, as you know, Rick, is to really just advance America's imperium, take control of one country after another. So whether it's in Eastern Congo or Rwanda or Burundi, or what's going on in Egypt now, the entire Middle East. I guess violence serves American interests, Rick, and that's one reason we have one war after another, and heaven help what may take place in Egypt. There literally is a possibility of civil war. Will it happen? Maybe not, but there certainly is a threat, and the comments and the quotes that I've used in my articles from very committed Muslim Brotherhood people, they are absolutely willing to die for what they believe in, and they believe that they'll be martyrs from doing it. I guess what they're saying is it's the equivalent of some people, maybe Western patriots, saying they would rather die on their feet than be serfs or slaves on their knees, and that's the way these people feel. And, of course, for the first time, they got an elected government in power, and it was swept away just like that with dirty American hands all over it, and they're very justifiably enraged, and they're doing something about it. So I think all bets are off, Rick. Anything can happen.
Yeah, incidentally, when we were talking about Tantawi, I'm looking up his Wikipedia entry, and it doesn't state anything about where he received his military training. It may even have happened in the Soviet Union, as far as I know, if it was done overseas. But this curious fact, or significant fact, is worth passing on, I think. It's stated that during so-called Operation Desert Storm, the Bush seniors' war against Iraq over Kuwait in 1991, that Tantawi commanded an Egyptian army unit on behalf of the United States. So this is the result of the Camp David Accord. This is a result of having switched Egypt from the column of the Soviet Union, and incidentally, from the non-aligned movement. You know, we have to recall that the real founder of the modern Egyptian state is Gamal Abdel Nasser, you know, who is one of the founders of the non-aligned movement. So when the U.S. bought off Anwar Sadat in 1979, they not only achieved a critical military ally in the Arab world and in Africa, one that controls the Suez Canal, moreover, but they also, you know, destroyed or helped destroy the non-aligned movement, and this is all conscious and deliberate policy on behalf of, the Carter administration of that time and everyone since, and that the military alliance that's manifested in the biennial Bright Star military exercises led to, amongst other things, the person who would ultimately become the head of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, leading a military unit attached to the U.S. war against Iraq in 1991. This is how the pieces, as you're indicating, Stephen, come together. I should also mention a friend of mine in Minnesota, Dan DeMeo, brought to my attention the other day something I couldn't believe, but evidently is true. The same Frank Wisner Jr. I've alluded to twice, his father, Frank Wisner Sr., is a man who incorporated most of the Nazi German Werwolf intelligence network into the Central Intelligence Agency during World War II. So it's quite a family tradition. And Frank Wisner Jr. was instrumental in orchestrating the succession, or so-called independence of Kosovo, amongst other things. But he is the uncle, the step-uncle of Nicolas Sarkozy.
Hmm.
Isn't that an amazing fact?
Oh, the strands tie together, Rick. I wanted to mention one thing. As I recall, Henry Kissinger was very, very much against rapprochement with Egypt, where Sadat, prior to 1979, really wanted peace with Israel. And it didn't happen. And I remember exactly where I was in 1973, the October so-called Yom Kippur War. And it was that war that turned Kissinger around, and he decided that we just can't have any more of this. Israel nearly lost that war. It was the only war Israel literally could have lost. And if it wasn't for emergency American aid, it might have turned out that way, where there were powerful forces against Israel, as powerful as Israel was, not as powerful as today. But it was a wake-up call for Kissinger, and they decided to turn around, and Camp David resulted after that. Well, it took a number of years, and with all the negotiations that went on, who knows, but Kissinger was behind it. I guess Brzezinski must have been involved as well, and the Camp David came about, and we've seen exactly what you related, Rick. We've got this horrible situation with Egypt in America's camp and part of America's imperial agenda.
Well, you know, there's even more to it that I think your listeners would appreciate hearing about. You know, and at 1979, I mean, the U.S. loses no time. When they buy off a leader, that there is an almost instantaneous transformation. They militarize the country, they realign the country, they purge political, you know, politically unreliable people. When Sadat was bought off in 1979 to the tune of billions, the U.S., the Carter administration, again, this is, you know, and his evil genius, if you will, is mad genius, Zbigniew Brzezinski, immediately created something called the Rapid Deployment Joint Task Force, which included Egypt, included, I believe, Oman, certainly Somalia, which had also been, you know, weaned away from the Soviet Union. The U.S. had supported Somalia in its war against Ethiopia over the Ogaden Desert. And the Rapid Deployment Joint Task Force was the nucleus of what eventually became, in 1983, under the Reagan administration, Central Command, U.S. Central Command, which now takes in, by the way, this is significant, the only country in the African continent, depending on how you count them, whether you include Western Sahara, for example, you know, 54, 55 countries, the only one that is not under the in the area of responsibility of U.S. Africa Command is Egypt, which remains to this day in U.S. Central Command. The very Central Command that was built out of the Rapid Deployment Joint Task Force, which was set up by the United States after they had recruited Egypt into their military column. So this is how, you know, long-standing a policy this has been. Central Command, by the way, goes all the way from Egypt to Kazakhstan on the Russian and Chinese border. It takes in the wars in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Yemen, in Somalia, not Somalia, I guess that's now Africa Command. But it takes in, you know, most of the major wars, the war zone in the world, really, is Central Command, and it all goes back to an Egyptian genesis or origin.
Again, it's a very disturbing situation, Rick, and you are really on top of this. And of course, it's all NATO-related as well, with NATO expanding, and maybe you can talk about the latest things going on with NATO. Let me bring up one other topic, and then we can go back either to Egypt, or you can update listeners on the latest that you've been discussing on NATO issues. But another issue that obsesses me is related to NSA spying and the fact that Obama is appointing a so-called independent commission to investigate NSA spying. And I wrote an article that I titled, if I can remember the exact title, Obama Appoints Spy Chief to Head NSA Investigation.
Yep.
And I learned that in 1975, Gerald Ford appointed Vice President Nelson Rockefeller to head a commission in charge of investigating U.S. intelligence agency abuses. Well, we know what happened from that one, Rick. Complete whitewash. Mm-hmm. And the biggest whitewash of all was the so-called 9/11 commission, with complete insiders stacking the commission. I mean, insiders, ex-governors, congressmen, senators, people of that sort.
If you recall, Henry Kissinger was first mentioned to head up that
panel. He was
the
one that Bush first wanted to head the commission, and it caused such an uproar that Kissinger stepped aside, and a man named Zelikow was appointed to head the commission, the executive director, I think. But you had Tom Keene, an ex-New Jersey governor. I got to think of who some of the others were.
We can go back to, Alan Dulles being on the Warren Commission, huh? The very CIA director who had been canned by JFK, and then when he's, when JFK is killed shortly thereafter, Dulles is on the Warren Commission.
Ex-Secretary of State.
I mean, this is, not John Foster. This is Alan Dulles, the
CIA
director.
I'm sorry, CIA.
So, I mean, this is not a case of putting the fox in charge of the hen house. I mean, I think that would be an understatement. I mean, this is, putting the assassin in charge of his own investigation.
Well, I ended my article with a line something like that. David Ray Griffin has written 10 books on 9/11, and one of them was called the 9/11 Commission, subtitled something like Distortions and Omissions. And my last line of my article was to the effect that maybe David Ray Griffin will write his newest book titled The Clapper. The guy Obama appointed is James Clapper, head of national intelligence. So I called him a spy chief. He is a spy chief. He doesn't have the NSA, but he's head of, director of national intelligence. That's the guy who's America's spy chief in charge of investigating NSA spying.
Within the family, Stephen.
The Clapper Commission, distortions, omissions, and bald-faced lies.
Very good.
I mean, we know it's coming from the Clapper Commission, but it's astonishing that these people do this over and over again, and it barely gets a ripple in the mainstream.
Yeah, the desensitization, both political and moral, of people. I'm not waxing nostalgic for it, and I'm certainly not idealizing or romanticizing any previous period in history. But I can assure you some of the outrage that we saw in the early 1970s that you were alluding to with, the intelligence investigations in the House and the Senate, following the report of extensive CIA operations within the United States, in violation of its own charter, and the whole Watergate period and so forth. I mean, there was a brief period of time where people seemed to be still capable of moral outrage. And it's very distressing to see how little of that there truly is now when revelations are being made that are far more serious and far more extensive, surely, than those made 40 years ago. And I don't know what it takes to rattle people out of their complacency or self-absorption and have them realize this is their world. And this is their telecommunication system that's being monitored. And they have dossiers on them, even if they don't have a political bone in their body.
Well, Rick, this is what bothers me more than anything. Back in the 1960s and 1970s, the civil rights struggles, the anti-war struggles, there was no internet. There was no way you could go online and stay up to date. You had to rely on the traditional sources, corporate-run newspapers and TV and so on. No cable TV back in those days. And yet there were tremendous, tremendous activism, people in the streets. It went on month after month after month, year after year, and great results. And now with all the resources available, it's so simple for people to find out what's going on and to stay informed with minimal effort. Do they do it? They don't do it. And I actually heard one person comment in relation to the NSA spying scandal, which it is, well, it doesn't affect my life. So, and you could fill in the last line, so why should I worry about it? I feel this is the attitude of too many people, and it literally lets America get away with murder and everything else.
Yeah, it's the German Pastor Bonhoeffer, isn't it? First they came for the communists and the socialists and all the way down the line. And when they came for me, there was nobody left to defend me. I mean, that's the name of the game.
We're on the same glide path, Rick. We really, really are. I mean, I can see it with all the police state laws that are on the book, with all the things that have happened, with the endless wars and more of them planned. Who knows what will happen in Syria? It's possible Washington will get directly involved instead of very, very heavily indirectly involved. Iran is a long-time target. I mean, you've got the whole Middle East in an uproar. You've got the Asia pivot with more U.S. Military support for the Philippines. Marines and troops in other countries. I mean, China must be absolutely enraged. And of course, these countries surrounded by U.S. military bases, you've got offensive missiles claimed to be missile defense. I'll talk about that a little bit, Rick. You've got a new article on South NATO about some kind of exercises off of Somalia, but I think the Asia pivot and literally challenging China and Russia are very, very serious business.
No, right you are. As a matter of fact, I think we discussed about a week and a half ago, there was an article of all places. I mean, I encourage your readers to go to places they don't traditionally go, to the Stars and Stripes website, you know, which is the official website of the U.S. Armed Forces. And they had an article about the U.S. Surrounding. I think they even used that word, encircling or surrounding China with advanced generation warplanes. And they were talking about, as you mentioned, the Philippines, Australia, Singapore, several other countries where the U.S. is going to be moving in pretty sophisticated multi-role combat aircraft, fighter jets and fighter bombers. To those countries and inevitably others around them, to the point where the high command of the Chinese military, the general staff, is going to be able to look at those deployments and figure out the inevitable conclusion, which is the U.S. is encircling it for some reason, and I would suspect more than just containing it, but ultimately to prepare it for first strike attack, and that's the whole purpose of so-called missile defense, of course, is to fend off whichever missiles survive a U.S. initial attack against Russia and China, we're talking about, and be able to neutralize those. So it emboldens the U.S. to play even more aggressive brinkmanship internationally, if it can convince countries like Russia and China they have no ability to effectively retaliate against a U.S. Attack, to then have them capitulate essentially politically in their own neighborhood, certainly internationally. And we do have to recollect that Russia and China, three times now, have jointly vetoed in the Security Council resolutions aimed against the government in Syria and aimed, let's be a little more candid about it, explicitly at the overthrow of the government in Syria. And this is, unprecedented during the Cold War or any other period. Never before have two permanent members of the UN Security Council jointly vetoed a similar resolution three times. And that's within a period of perhaps 18 months or less. Back to Egypt, though, before we wrap up, we have to alert people, and I'm sure everyone in Egypt knows this, that the U.S.'s plan is not ultimately simply to plunge the country into chaos. It has succeeded in doing that. But what I'm afraid is going to happen again is the U.S. is going to create and exacerbate divisions within Egyptian society that may take decades to heal, if at all. Exactly what they're doing in Syria right now, exactly what they did in Libya 2.5 years ago. And that is to say, Muslim against Christian, secular Muslim against politicized Islamist, north against south, city against village, any conceivable, ethnic Greek in Alexandria against Arab, whatever division they can create and worsen, they are going to do it. And that's what I'm afraid is occurring right now. And, when blood is spilt along sectarian and other bases, it's very difficult to patch that up.
Well, it's very true, Rick. And the last thing that America wants is to see peace and stability break out. It defeats America's agenda. It needs violence and instability and conflict because that's the way America could justify its presence and involvement. And one thing leads to another. We see what's happening one war after another. It's a very, very deplorable situation. I agree with you, Rick, that America is really stoking these conflicts and keeping them going. And literally, we have just a deplorable situation. We're just about out of time. Let me give you the last comment.
Well, I thank you again for providing not only a sympathetic but a stimulating environment in which to have these discussions. And I'm sure it's no surprise, I mean, certainly not to you and to many of your listeners, that, the more we have a forum or a context for dialoguing as we're doing, the more we all think with greater clarity. We not only learn from other people by engaging with each other in the sorts of discussions we have, Stephen, we're all the gainers by this. We all come away with new insights or new connections that we didn't have before and might never have had. So it's critical in a friendly and non-antagonistic way for people like ourselves to conduct these sorts of discussions. And I thank you, deeply for providing the mechanism through which we can do that.
Well, Rick, I thank you for coming on because it's guests like you that inform my listeners who I hope will inform others who may not listen to programs like this. that they need to know these kind of things because they affect their lives directly. And if they don't look after their welfare, nobody's going to do it for them. If they think the politicians are going to do something, if they think they can get change through the ballot box, they're kidding themselves. But my listeners know that. I just ask them to pass it on to others because we're responsible for our own futures, our own welfare. Again, nobody's going to do it for us. Rick, many, many thanks. I look forward to having you back.
I look forward to being back.
Thanks, Rick. Join us over the weekend. We'll be on at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Friday's always at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.